Marvin, pleased to meet you. She was British. Marvin recognised the accent from the TV. He always thought that Britain would be a good place for him, with his crooked teeth and fondness for rain. There you are, Alice. What have I told you about talking to strangers? The woman who had joined them was looking at him as though he might bite. He's not a stranger. He's Marvin. Marvin smiled his best smile and offered the woman the best from his bag.
Free umbrella?
The woman ignored him. She snatched Alice's hand and tried to drag her away. Trash. That's how she was treating him, like he was trash. Marvin's face grew hot. The hairs on the back of his neck prickled, and his ears began to ring. He was not trash.
Take it!
He roared, thrusting the umbrella at her.
Don't touch me, you moron!
She hissed as she turned on her heel, towing a tearful Alice behind her. As soon as her mother's grip slackened, Alice pulled free and ran back towards the sculpture.
Marvin!
She yelled, desperately wanting to make things right. Their eyes met, and before her mother could retrieve her, Alice blew him a kiss, and he caught it. Before he went home, he left a white umbrella with red hearts leaning against the white rabbit, just in case she came back.
Laura yawned and stretched back into her chair. She checked her watch. 3 hours in front of the screen was more than enough for today. She needed some air. "Come on, Carrot," she said. "Time for a walk." Outside, the sky was marbled grey. "Looks like rain," she said to the reluctant dog. "I think we might need an umbrella."
Chapter 29. The dining room looked like something out of a fairy tale. The table was laid with a snow-white linen tablecloth and napkins. Silver cutlery framed each place setting, and cut crystal glasses winked and sparkled under the light from the chandelier. It was her first Christmas as mistress of Padua, and Laura wanted to do the house justice. If she did, perhaps it would banish the unwelcome thoughts that crept into her head like black ants through a crack in the wall of a pantry. She just couldn't shake the feeling that the previous mistress still hadn't quite gone. She pulled the silver and white crackers from their cardboard box and set one on top of each precisely folded napkin. That morning, even in the dark, she knew that something in the bedroom had changed. It was the same feeling that had told her, as a child on Christmas morning, that the stocking at the foot of her bed, empty when she had fallen asleep, was now full. She could sense, somehow, the alteration. As she padded over to the window in bare feet, she trod on things which were not the carpet. Soft, hard, sharp, smooth. Daylight confirmed that the drawers of the dressing table had been pulled out and their contents strewn across the floor. Laura picked up one of the wine glasses and polished away an imaginary smudge. Sunshine and her mum and dad were coming for Christmas dinner. Her brother had been invited, but he wasn't bothered. Freddie was coming too. She hadn't known whether to ask him or not, but a stern pep talk from Sarah had convinced her. He said yes, and since then, Laura had wasted an inordinate amount of time trying to work out why. Her hypotheses were numerous and varied. She'd caught him by surprise. He was lonely. He wanted a roast turkey dinner but couldn't cook. He had nowhere else to go. He felt sorry for her. The one explanation she was most reluctant, but also most excited to entertain, was the simplest and most nerve-wracking. He was coming because he wanted to. Perhaps she had done it in her sleep, like sleepwalking, sleep trashing. It wasn't a burglary because nothing was missing. Yesterday she had found Sunshine in the garden room, dancing to the Al Bowley song that had begun to haunt her night and day. "Did you put the music on?" Sunshine shook her head.
It was already on, and when I heard it, I came in for the dance.
Laura had never known Sunshine to tell a lie.
They're done!
Sunshine burst into the dining room looking at her watch. She had been making mince pies, and now the kitchen was dusty with flour and icing sugar. Laura followed Sunshine as she trotted purposefully back to the kitchen and hopped from foot to foot excitedly while Laura took the pies from the oven. "They smell lovely," she said, and Sunshine blushed proudly.
"Just in time," said Freddy,
as he came in through the back door, accompanied by a blast of freezing cold air.
"Time for the lovely cup of tea and an even lovelier mince pie."
As they sat round the table, drinking tea and fanning mouthfuls of mince pies, which were still a little too hot, Freddy gazed thoughtfully at Laura.
"What's up?" he asked.
"Nothing." It was a reflex rather than an answer. Freddy raised his eyebrows. Sunshine shoved the rest of her mince pie in and then spoke with her mouth full.
"That's a lie."
Freddy laughed out loud.
"Well, no points for tact there, but 10 out of 10 for honesty."
They both looked at Laura expectantly. She told them about the dressing table, the music, even about the shadow figure in the rose garden. Sunshine was unimpressed.
"It's just the lady," she said, as though it ought to have been obvious.
"And what lady might that be?"
Freddy asked, keeping his eyes firmly fixed on Laura.
"St. Anthony's wedding wife, the Lady of the Flowers."
She reached for another mince pie and dropped it under the table for Carrot. Freddy winked at her and mouthed, "I saw that." Sunshine almost smiled.
"But why would she still be here, now that Anthony's gone?"
Laura surprised herself by taking the idea seriously enough to ask.
"Yes, why would she still be here making a mess and disturbing the peace? And after we gave her such a lovely wedding, too?"
Laura had no idea if Freddy was being serious or not. Sunshine shrugged.
"She's upset."
Despite her scepticism, Laura's stomach tipped like a tombola machine. Christmas Day dawned bright and sunny, and as Laura ambled round the garden with Carrot, her spirits lifted. Christmas Eve had passed uneventfully, and she had even been to midnight mass at the local church. She'd had a few words with God, and maybe that had helped. Laura and God didn't get together too often, but he was still on her Christmas card list. Sunshine and her mum and dad arrived at 12 on the dot.
"Sunshine's been ready since 8,
her mum told Laura as she took their coats.
"She'd have been here for breakfast if we'd let her."
Laura introduced them to Freddy. "This is Stella, and this is Stan."
"We call ourselves the SS," Stella chuckled.
"It's very kind of you to invite us." Stan grinned and thrust a poinsettia and a bottle of pink carver at Laura.
"There's nothing like a drop of pink fizz at Christmas," said Stella, smoothing down the front of her best dress and checking her hair in the hall mirror.
As Sunshine proudly gave them a guided tour of the house, Stella and Stan oohed and aahed appreciatively. Back in the kitchen, Freddy was whisking gravy, basting roast potatoes, stabbing boiling Brussels sprouts, and drinking vodka martinis, and occasionally sneaking an appreciative glance at Laura. A couple of times, their eyes met, and he refused to look away. Laura was beginning to feel rather warm. He had insisted on helping, to show his appreciation for the invitation. He raised his glass to Laura.
"If they're the SS, then I'm 007.
Christmas dinner was every bit as glorious as it ought to be. In the fairy tale setting of silver and white and sparkle, they ate too much, drank too much, pulled crackers, and told terrible jokes. Carrot camped out under the table taking titbits from whichever hand offered them. Laura discovered that Stella was in a book club and did flamenco, and Stan was in the darts team at his local pub. They were currently second in the league, and with three more matches in hand, they were hoping to take the championship. But Stan's real passion was music. Much to Freddie's delight, they shared a broad and eclectic taste, from David Bowie to Art Pepper to The Proclaimers to Etta James. It was easy to see where Sunshine's love of music and dancing came from. While Laura, Sunshine and Stella cleared the table and then set about tackling the bomb site that had once been the kitchen, Freddie and Stan slumped back in their chairs like a pair of deflated soufflés.
"That was the best Christmas dinner I've had in years."
Stan rubbed his belly affectionately.
"Only don't tell the missus," he added, winking at Freddie.
Carrot had ventured out from under the table and was sleeping contentedly at Freddy's side. Freddie poured Stan a glass of whiskey.
"So is it as great as it sounds, being a train driver? Every schoolboy's dream?"
Stan swirled the amber-coloured liquid in his glass and sniffed it approvingly.
"For the most part," he replied. "Some days I feel like I'm the luckiest man alive. But I nearly packed it in before I really got started."
He sipped his whiskey, reaching back for once to the memories he had struggled so hard to forget.
"I'd only been driving solo for a couple of weeks. It was my last run of the day, cold and dark outside, and I was looking forward to my dinner. I didn't even see her until she hit the cab. After that, there wasn't much left of her to see."
He took another sip of his whiskey, bigger this time.
"It was in the local paper. She was ill, they said. Bad nerves. Stood waiting in the cold, waiting for my train. Terrible shame it was. She had a nipper, a girl. Dear little thing. They put her picture in the paper."
Freddie shook his head and whistled through his teeth.
"Jesus, Stan, I'm sorry."
Stan drained his glass and thumped it down on the table.
"It's the whiskey," he said. "It makes me maudlin. It was a long time ago. Thank God Stella drummed some sense into me and persuaded me to carry on driving."
They sat in silence for a moment, and then Stan added,
"Not a word to Sunshine, though. I never told her. Of course."
Carrot's ears flicked at the sound of footsteps in the hall. Sunshine came in, carrying a tray, followed by Laura and Stella. She set the tray down on the table.
"Now it's time for the lovely cup of tea and the even lovelier mince pies," she said, pointing at the plate piled high. "And then we're going to play conveniences."
Halfway through the first round, Sunshine remembered something that she had been meaning to tell her parents.
"Freddy's crap in the sack."
Freddie nearly choked on his whiskey, but Stella responded with admirable composure.
"What on earth makes you think that?"
"Felicity told me. She's Freddy's girlfriend."
"Not any more," growled Freddy.
Stan was shaking with laughter, and Freddy was clearly mortified, but Sunshine was undeterred.
"What does it mean, crap in the sack?"
"It means not very good at kissing."
It was the first thing that came into Laura's head.
"Perhaps you should do more practice then," said Sunshine kindly, patting Freddy's hand.
When Sunshine and the SS went home, the house fell silent. Laura was left alone with Carrot and Freddy. But where was he? He'd disappeared while she had been seeing Sunshine and the SS out and waving them off. She felt like a giddy teenager, uncertain if she was excited or afraid. It was the wine, she told herself. Freddy came out of the garden room and took her by the hand.
"Come."
The garden room was lit with dozens of candles, and there was a bottle of champagne chilling in an ice bucket, flanked by two glasses.
"Will you dance with me?"
Freddy asked. As he placed the needle on the record, Laura spoke silently to God for the second time in as many days. Please, please let it not be Al Bowley. In Freddie's arms, she wished that Ella Fitzgerald would improvise a few more verses for someone to watch over me. Freddie looked up, and Laura followed his gaze to the bunch of mistletoe that he had attached to the chandelier above their heads.
Practice makes perfect, he whispered.
As they kissed, the photograph of Therese shattered silently into a starburst of splintered glass.
Chapter 30. Eunice, 1989. The photographs on the sideboard were supposed to help Godfrey remember who people were, but they didn't always work. As Bomber, Eunice and Baby Jane came into the sunny sitting room, Godfrey reached for his wallet.
"I'll have a tenner on my bill in the 2:45 at Kempton Park."
Grace patted him affectionately on the hand. "Godfrey, darling, it's Bomber, your son." Godfrey peered at Bomber over the top of his spectacles and shook his head.
"Rubbish! Don't you think that I'd know my own son? Can't remember this chap's name, but he's definitely my bookie."
Eunice could see the tears welling up in Bomber's eyes, as he remembered the countless times he had placed bets for his father under the strict instruction, "Don't tell your mother." She took Godfrey gently by the arm. "It's a beautiful place you have here, and it's a lovely day. I wonder if you'd be kind enough to show me round the gardens." Godfrey smiled at her, delighted.
"It will be my pleasure, young lady. I expect my dog could do with a walk, too," he said, looking at Baby Jane with a slightly puzzled air. "Although, I must confess, I'd almost forgotten I had him."
Godfrey put on the hat that Grace passed to him.
"Come along, Bomber," he said to Baby Jane. "Time to stretch our legs."
However offended Baby Jane might have been about being mistaken for a boy dog with her master's name, she hid it well. Better than Bomber managed to hide his sadness at being mistaken for his father's bookie. Grace put her hand to his face.
"Chin up, darling. I know it's tough. Yesterday morning he sat bolt upright in bed and accused me of being Marianne Faithful."
Bomber smiled in spite of himself.
"Come on, Ma. We'd best follow them before they get into mischief."
Outside, the vapour trail of a plane was scrawled across the blue sky like the knobbled spine of a prehistoric animal. Folly's End House, sadly, had no folly, but it did have very beautiful and extensive gardens for its residents to enjoy. Grace and Godfrey had moved in just over 3 months ago, when it became clear that Godfrey's reason had set sail for faraway climes, and Grace could no longer cope with him alone. He occasionally took a brief shore leave in reality, but for the most part, the old Godfrey had jumped ship. Folly's End was the perfect harbour. They had their own rooms, but help was on hand when they needed it. Godfrey strolled arm in arm with Eunice in the sunshine, greeting everyone they met with a smile. Baby Jane ran ahead. When she stopped for a wee, Godfrey shook his head and tutted.
"Oh, I do wish that dog would learn to cock his leg. Next thing we know, he'll be wearing lilac and singing show tunes."
They stopped at a wooden bench by an ornamental fish pond and sat down. Baby Jane stood right at the edge of the pond, fascinated by the flashes and swirls of silver and gold, as the koi carp gathered in hope of food.
"Don't even think about it," Eunice warned. "It's not sushi."
As Grace and Bomber caught up with them, Godfrey was telling Eunice about all the other residents.
"We've got Mick Jagger, Peter Ustinov, Harold Wilson, Angela Rippon, Elvis Presley, Googie Withers and Mrs. Johnson, who used to run the laundrette in Stanley Street. And you'll never guess who I woke up in bed with the other morning."
Eunice shook her head agog. Godfrey paused for a moment and then shook his head sadly.
"No, and neither will I. I had it a moment ago, and now it's gone."
"You told me it was Marianne Faithful," said Grace, trying to be helpful. Godfrey laughed out loud. "Now that I think I would remember," he said, winking at Bomber. "By the by, have you placed my bet yet?" Before Bomber could answer, Eunice directed his attention to a distant figure wearing enormous sunglasses and vertiginous heels, teetering in their direction. "Oh, God," moaned Bomber. "What on earth does she want?" It took Portia some while to reach them across the lawn, and Eunice watched her precarious progress with quiet amusement. Baby Jane had jumped, unbidden, into Godfrey's lap and was warming up her growl. Godfrey watched Portia's approach with only mild curiosity, and no sign of recognition whatsoever.
"Hello, Mummy. Hello, Daddy,"
Portia crowed without enthusiasm. Godfrey looked behind himself to see who she was talking to. "Portia," began Bomber gently. "He doesn't always remember." Before he could finish, she had squashed herself next to Godfrey on the bench and tried to take his hand. Baby Jane growled a warning, and Portia leapt to her feet.
"Oh, for pity's sake! Not that vicious dog again!"
Godfrey clutched Baby Jane protectively.
"Don't you speak about my dog like that, young woman! Who are you, anyway? Go away at once and leave us in peace!"
Portia was livid. She had driven 20 miles from London with a banging hangover and got lost 3 times on the way. And she was missing Charlotte's designer bags and belts brunch.
"Don't be so bloody ridiculous, Daddy. You know damn well that I'm your daughter. Just because I'm not here every 5 minutes sucking up to you like your precious bloody son and his pathetic lovelorn sidekick. You know bloody well who I am," she fumed.
Godfrey was unmoved.
"Young woman," he said, looking at her scarlet face, "you have clearly been out in the sun without a hat for far too long, and have taken leave of your senses. No daughter of mine would use such language or behave in such an abhorrent manner. And this man is my bookie."
"And what about her?" Portia sneered, pointing at Eunice. Godfrey smiled.
"This is Marianne Faithful."
Grace managed to persuade Portia to go inside with her for a drink. Bomber, Eunice, Godfrey and Baby Jane continued on their stroll around the gardens. Under one of the apple trees, a small table was laid for tea, and an elegant, elderly lady sat drinking from a cup and saucer with a younger woman who was eating a lemon curd tart.
"They're my favourite,"
she announced as they said hello in passing.
"Would you like one?"
She offered them the glass cake stand. Bomber and Eunice declined, but Godfrey helped himself. Baby Jane personified dejection. The elderly lady smiled and said to her companion,
"Eliza, I think you have forgotten someone."
Baby Jane got two. Back in the main house, they found Grace alone.
"Where's Portia?" Bomber asked.
"Taken herself back to London in high dudgeon, I shouldn't wonder," said Grace. "I tried to reason with her, but..."
She shrugged sadly.
"I don't understand how she could behave so appallingly," said Bomber.
Grace glanced over to where Godfrey was chatting to Eunice to make sure that he was out of earshot.
"I think I can."
Grace took Bomber's arm and led him over to the sofa.
"I remember when she was very young."
She sighed sadly, summoning the memory of her small daughter with a gap-toothed smile and uneven pigtails.
"She always was her daddy's little girl."
Bomber took her hand and squeezed it.
"And now she's losing him," Grace continued. "And perhaps, for the first time in her adult life, she's faced with something that her money can't fix. Her heart is breaking, and she can do nothing about it."
"Except hurt those who love her," replied Bomber crossly.
Grace patted his knee.
"She simply doesn't know how to cope. She left here in floods of tears, having called her darling daddy a wicked old trout."
Bomber gave his mother a hug.
"Never mind, Ma. You've always got your precious bloody son."
Just as they were leaving,
Godfrey beckoned Eunice over to his side.
"A word in your ear." He winked conspiratorially at her and lowered his voice. "Pretty damn sure that woman was my daughter. But there have to be some consolations for having this ruddy awful disease."
Chapter 31. According to Sunshine, Laura had had Freddy on a sleepover. But Laura had not had Freddy on a sleepover. She had slept with him in the same bed, but she had not slept with him. Laura smiled to herself at how peculiarly British it was, using the same words for different meanings, but still not actually saying what you mean. Sex. She had not had sex with Freddy. Yet. There. In the space of a few sentences, she had gone from innuendo to intercourse. On Christmas night, she and Freddy had danced and drunk champagne and talked, and talked and talked. She had told him all about school and tray cloths and Vince. She had told him about the baby she had lost, and he had held her close. And she told him about the short stories that she had written for Feathers Lace and Fantasy Fiction, and he laughed until he cried. He had told her about his ex-fiancée, Heather, a recruitment consultant who wanted marriage and children, and he didn't. At least, not with her. He had also told her why he'd sold his small IT consultancy, much to Heather's consternation and the final wheel to fall off their relationship, to become a gardener. He'd got sick of watching the world through a window instead of living outside in it. Laura finally told him about Graham and their disastrous date, and after some hesitation and another glass of champagne, she even told him about the kiss. He grinned.
"Well, at least you haven't rushed upstairs yet to swill your mouth out, so I'll take that as a good sign. And I hope you kept that dress."
He was quiet for a moment.
"I was too embarrassed to kiss a girl until I was 17 because of this," he said, lightly touching the scar that ran onto his mouth. "I was born with a cleft lip, and the surgeon's needlework wasn't the neatest."
Laura leaned forward and kissed him softly on the mouth. "Well, it certainly doesn't seem to hamper your technique now." Freddy told her all about Felicity, a blind date set up by a woman whose garden he'd been working on for several years. She swore they'd get on like a house on fire. They didn't. But Felicity was one of the woman's closest friends, so Freddy carried on seeing her whilst trying to work out a dignified escape route.
"One night, I couldn't face any more of her bragging and braying and calling me bloody Freddo, so I just stood her up. Not very dignified, I know, but damned effective as it turned out. I lost my client, but it was worth it."
Finally, when Freddy and Laura had run out of words, they took comfort in each other's arms, sleeping furled around one another like petals in a bud. They slept in the guest bedroom next to Therese's old room. The day Laura woke to find the drawers emptied onto the floor, she had moved her things into the room next door. She wasn't afraid, exactly. Or perhaps she was, a little. She had a horrible feeling that there was, if not a spectre, then an uninvited guest at her feast. A soup spoon was missing. One of the table legs was too short. One of the champagne cocktails was flat. One of the second violins was sharp. A sliver of disharmony jangled Padua, and Laura had no idea what she should do to restore peace. Carrot would never go into Therese's bedroom, but he was perfectly happy to abandon his place by the fire on Christmas night to nestle at their feet on the bed where Freddy and Laura slept. When Sunshine found out about the sleepover, she wanted to know all the details. Whose pyjamas did Freddy wear? How did he clean his teeth without his toothbrush? Did he snore? And did they kiss? Freddy told her that he had borrowed one of Laura's nighties, cleaned his teeth with soap and a flannel, and no, he didn't snore, but Laura did, enough to rattle the windows, and yes, they had kissed. Sunshine wanted to know if Freddy was any better at kissing now, and he told her that he'd been having lessons. Laura had never seen Sunshine laugh so hard, but how much of it she believed was difficult to guess. How much of it she would repeat when she got home wasn't. It was New Year's Eve, and still very early. The guest room also had a view of the rose garden, but this morning it was barely visible through the driving rain. Freddie would be here later. They were going out this evening to join the celebrations at the local pub. But in the meantime, Laura was drawn inexorably to the study. Armed with enough toast for both of them and a pot of tea, Laura went into the study, followed by Carrot, and lit a fire. She took a small box down from its shelf and laid the contents on the table. Outside, it was raining harder than ever, and the sound of running water played counterpoint to the spit and crackle of the fire. For the first time, Laura held in her hand an object she could not name, and even after reading its label, she was no wiser as to its purpose or origin.
Wooden house, painted door and windows, number 32. Found in a skip outside number 32 Marley Street, the 23rd of October. Edna peered at the young man's identity card. He said he was from the water board, come to check all the plumbing and the pipes. It was just a courtesy call. They were doing it for all their customers over 70 before the winter set in, he said. Edna was 78, and she needed her reading glasses to see what was on the card. Her son David was always telling her to be extra careful about opening the door to strangers. "Always keep the chain on until you know who they are," he warned. The trouble was that with the chain on she could only open the door a crack, and then she was too far away from it to read the card, even with her reading glasses on. The young man smiled patiently. He looked right. He was wearing a smart pair of overalls with a badge on the right-hand chest pocket, and was carrying a black plastic toolbox. The identity card had a photo that looked like him, and she thought that she could just about make out the words Thames and water. She let him in. She didn't want him thinking she was a foolish, helpless old woman. "Would you like a cup of tea?" she asked. He smiled gratefully. "You're a diamond and no mistake. I'm proper parched. Last brew I had was at 7 o'clock this morning. Milk and two sugars and I'm a happy man." She directed him to the downstairs lavatory, and then upstairs to the bathroom and airing cupboard on the landing which housed the water tank. In the kitchen, she put the kettle on, and as she waited for it to boil, she looked out at the long strip of back garden. Edna had lived in her East London terrace for nearly 60 years. She and Ted had moved in when they got married. They had brought up their kids here, and by the time David and his sister Diane had grown up and left home, it was bought and paid for. Of course, they could never have afforded it now. Edna was the only one left from the old days. One by one, the houses had been bought up, tarted up, and their prices hiked up as high as a Tom's skirt, as her Ted would have said. These days the street was full of young professionals with flash cars, fondue sets, and more money than they knew what to waste it on. Not like the old days, when kids played in the street and you knew all your neighbours and their business. The young man found his way back into the kitchen just as Edna was pouring the tea. "Just how I like it," he said, gulping it down. He seemed to be in a hurry. "Everything's ship-shape upstairs." He took a quick look under the sink in the kitchen, and then rinsed his mug under the tap. Edna was impressed. He was a good boy, like her David. His mum had obviously brought him up well. Early that afternoon, the doorbell rang again. Two visitors in one day was almost unheard of. The crack revealed a small, smartly dressed black woman, who appeared to be somewhere in her 60s. She was wearing a navy blue suit with a blouse so white it dazzled. Perched on her concrete-set coiffure of brandy-snap curls sat a navy blue hat with a wisp of spotted net that just covered the top half of her face. Before either of them could speak, the woman appeared to buckle at the knees and clutched at the doorframe to prevent herself from falling. Moments later, she was sitting in Edna's kitchen, fanning her face with her hand and apologizing profusely in a rich Jamaican accent.
"I'm so sorry, my dear. It's just one of my funny turns. The doctor says it's to do with my sugars."
She lurched forward in her chair and almost fell off it before recovering herself.
"I feel so bad imposing myself on you like this."
Edna flapped away her apologies.
"What you need is a hot, sweet cup of tea," she said, filling the kettle once again.
To be honest, she was glad of the company. The woman introduced herself as Sister Ruby. She was knocking on doors, offering her skills as a spiritual healer, reader, and advisor. She told Edna that she could read palms, cards, and crystals, and was a practitioner of Obeah, Jadu, and Juju. Edna had no idea about Obadiah, Jedi, or Judy, but she had always been fascinated by fortune-tellers and the like, and was deeply superstitious. Hers was a house where new shoes were never put on the table, umbrellas were never opened indoors, and nobody crossed on the stairs. Her Irish grandmother had read tea leaves for all the neighbours, and one of her aunts made her living as Madame Petulengra, giving crystal ball readings on Brighton Pier. When Sister Ruby, revived by her tea, offered to read Edna's palm, she was only too willing. Sister Ruby took Edna's hand, palm upwards in her own, and passed her other hand over it several times. She then spent a full minute studying the crinkled topography of Edna's palm.
"You have two children," she said at last, "a boy and a girl."
Edna nodded.
"Your husband passed 8 years ago. He had a pain here."
Sister Ruby clutched at her chest with her free hand. Ted had died of a heart attack on the way home from the pub. Family flowers only, but donations, if desired, to the British Heart Foundation. Sister Ruby tipped Edna's hand this way and that, as though she were trying to decipher a particularly complex message.
"You're worried about your home," she finally announced. "You want to stay, but someone wants you to leave. Is a man? Is it your son? No."
She peered closely at Edna's hand, and then leaned back and closed her eyes, as though trying to picture the man in question. Suddenly, she sat bolt upright and slapped her hands flat on the table.
"He's a businessman. He want to buy your house."
Over a second cup of tea in a newly opened packet of Bourbons, Edna told Sister Ruby all about Julius Winsgrave, property developer, entrepreneur, and sleazy, greedy gobshite. Except she didn't use the word gobshite, what with Ruby being a sister-in-law. He had been trying to get her to sell for years, having bought most of the other houses in the street and made a killing on them. In the end, his bully boy tactics had forced David to consult his solicitor and take out an injunction against Julius to prevent any further harassment. But Edna always felt the threat of him circling above like a vulture, waiting for her to die. Sister Ruby listened carefully.
"He sound like a bad and dangerous man."
She reached down and picked up her capacious, well-used handbag and began rifling through its contents.
"I have something here that can definitely help you."
She placed on the table a small, flat piece of wood in the shape of the front of a house. It was crudely painted, with four windows and a blue front door, the same colour as Edna's.
"What number is your house, please?" Sister Ruby asked.
32. Sister Ruby took a pen from her bag and drew a large 32 on the front door of the house.
"Now," she said, "this is the most powerful juju, and it will protect you as long as you do exactly as I say."
She held the house tightly in both hands and closed her eyes. Her lips worked furiously in silent incantation for several minutes before she finally placed the house in the centre of the kitchen table.
"Here it must stay," she said decisively.
This is the centre of your home, and from here it will protect you. But you must know that now this house, she said, pointing to the wooden model, has become your house. All the while you keep it safe, so too will your house be safe. But if you allow harm to come to it, the same and more will come to the bricks and mortar around you. Whether it be fire, water, breaking, whatever, nothing can undo the magic, and nothing can undo the curse. Edna looked at the little wooden house, and wondered if it could really protect her from Julius Winsgrave. Well, it certainly couldn't do any harm to try it. Sister Ruby took her cup and saucer to the sink, and, despite Edna's protests, washed them thoroughly before setting them on the draining board to dry. As Edna turned her back to put the biscuits in their tin, Sister Ruby shook a wet hand over the wooden house, and three drops of water splashed onto its painted façade. "There now," she said, picking up her bag. "I've taken up quite enough of your time." Edna was searching for her purse, but Sister Ruby refused to take any payment for her services. "It was a pleasure chatting with you," she said as she made her way towards the front door. As the makeup came off, the face in the mirror grew younger. Under the fat curls of the wig was black hair, ironed straight. In jeans, boots, and a leopard-print coat, Sister Ruby disappeared into Simone LaSalle. She checked her designer watch and grabbed her designer bag. At the restaurant, Julius was already waiting, drumming his fingers impatiently on the immaculate linen tablecloth. "Champagne, please," she told the passing waiter in confident estuary English. Julius raised his eyebrows. "Do you deserve it?" Simone smiled. "What do you think?" she said. "It went like clockwork. My boy went this morning and sorted the stopcock. As luck would have it, the bathroom was directly above the kitchen." She checked her watch again. "The kitchen ceiling should be down by now." Julius smiled. "Mother and son make a good team." He pushed a fat brown envelope across the table. Simone checked the contents and then slid it into her bag. The waiter brought the champagne and filled both their glasses. Julius made the toast. "It's been a pleasure doing business with you." After seeing Sister Ruby out, Edna went for a little lie down on the sofa. Two visitors in one day were lovely, but a little tiring. When she woke about an hour later, it was raining. In the kitchen, the wooden house on the table was soaked. The paint had run and the windows had all but washed away, but the number 32 was still plainly visible. Edna looked up and saw a dark patch creeping horribly across the ceiling. The last thing she heard was the groan of lath and plaster surrendering.
"Okay, okay, I surrender." Laura stroked the warm head that had been gently butting her knee for the last 5 minutes. Carrot was hungry, and he needed a wee. It was long past lunchtime. Laura surveyed the sea of objects dotted with gold stars in front of her on the table, and then checked her watch. It was nearly 3 o'clock. "Poor Carrot," she said. "I bet you've been keeping your legs crossed." It was still pouring with rain, but fortunately Carrot had been given, amongst a great many other things, a waterproof coat for Christmas. He trotted out into the garden whilst Laura made their lunch. He was soon back, padding a pattern of wet paw prints across the floor tiles. After lunch, Laura went upstairs to decide on her outfit for that evening. She embarrassed herself with how long it took to choose appropriate underwear. Appropriately inappropriate. Searching for a favourite pair of earrings, she wondered if she might have left them in Therese's bedroom and went to look. She turned the cold brass doorknob. The door was locked.
from the inside. Chapter 32 Freddy poked Carrot with his toe from underneath the bed covers.
Get up, you lazy hound, and go and make us a cup of tea.
Carrot snuggled deeper into his duvet nest and groaned contentedly. Freddy looked at Laura pleadingly, and she promptly hid her head under the pillow.
I suppose it's down to me, then, he said,
hopping out of bed and searching for something to put on for the sake of warmth rather than modesty. Laura's dressing gown was hardly fit for purpose, but conveniently to hand. Freddy threw open the curtains onto a new year and a blue sky and sunshine day. Laura stretched out, naked under the warm covers, and wondered if she had time to nip to the bathroom and make herself look a little more presentable, a little less middle-aged. But then, what was the point? Freddy had already seen her. Laura raked through her hair with her fingers and checked in the small mirror on the bedside table to see if she had any of last night's mascara smudged underneath her eyes. At least she had nice teeth. It was a full 2 hours later before they were up, dressed and eating beans on toast, when Sunshine arrived. They had promised her that if it was a nice day, they would all take Carrot for a walk on the nearby common. Laura and Freddy strolled arm in arm as Sunshine ran ahead with Carrot, throwing a ball on a rope, another Christmas present, for him to retrieve.
I get the distinct impression that young Carrot is only going along with this for Sunshine's amusement rather than his own, said Freddy.
Laura watched as Carrot dutifully returned the ball to Sunshine, only to have her fling it away in a random direction and command that he fetch. I suspect that he'll only play along for so long before he finds something more interesting to do. Sure enough, after the very next throw, Carrot watched as the ball descended into a gorse bush and then wandered off to look for rabbits. Poor Freddy was designated by Sunshine as Carrot's second and was soon elbow deep in gorse spines. Leave it, said Laura, as Freddy risked multiple puncture wounds. We'll get him another one.
No, wailed Sunshine. It was the Christmas present to him. He'll be really upsetted, and he'll hate me because I can't throw straight in a line because I'm a Ming-Mong.
Sunshine was close to tears.
You most certainly are not a Ming-Mong, said Freddy,
finally surfacing from the depths of the gorse bush, triumphantly waving the ball on a rope.
Who on earth called you that?
That's what Nicola Crow used to call me at school when I dropped the ball in rounders.
Well, Nicola Crow was an ignoramus, and you, young lady, are dancing drome. And don't you forget it.
He handed her the toy, smoothing away the pain from her face. But a smile was still too much to hope for. Tired of rabbits and having missed all the drama, Carrot wandered back and sniffed at his toy. Then he licked Sunshine's hand, the price of a smile. As they walked on, Laura now holding Carrot's toy for safekeeping and Freddy inspecting his wounds, Sunshine pounced on a small shiny object trodden into the grass.
Look,
she said, digging it out of the mud with her fingers.
What is it?
Freddy took it from her and rubbed the dirt away. It was a brass keyring in the shape of a baby elephant.
We should take it home, said Sunshine. We should write it a label and put it on the website.
Don't you think that we've got more than enough lost things already? Said Laura, picturing the study crammed with things still waiting on shelves or in boxes for their gold stars. But Freddy agreed with Sunshine.
Listen, I've been thinking about how we get people interested in the website. Putting all the stuff on there is only half the job. Getting the right people to look at it is the other. Now, Anthony's is a great story, and I'm sure we'll be able to get the local press, maybe even radio and television interested. But if we have some really recent things that have been lost and found, as well as all the old stuff, I think it could really help.
And what really helped Laura was that Freddy had said we. She was no longer facing Anthony's daunting legacy alone. she had help. Help that she had been too proud or too afraid to ask for. Back at Padua, Sunshine went straight to the study to find a label for the keyring. They had all been invited to tea by Sunshine's mum and dad, but she was determined to have the label written and the keyring on a shelf or in a box before they left. Laura went upstairs to get changed, and Freddie rubbed the worst of the mud from Carrot's feet and legs with an old towel in the kitchen. On the way past, Laura tried the door handle of Therese's room. It was still locked. Back in the kitchen, she wrote a label for the keyring under Sunshine's watchful eye. Sunshine? Hmm? She was concentrating hard to make out what Laura was writing. You know, the other day, when you said that the Lady of the Flowers was upset? Yep. Laura put the pen down and blew on the wet ink. As soon as she put the label down, Sunshine picked it up and blew on it some more, just to be sure. Well, do you think that she's upset with me? Sunshine adopted her how-can-you-be-so-stupid expression and stance, which involved rolling her eyes, huffing, and jamming her hands onto her hips. She's not upsetted with just you. The of course was understood. She's upsetted with everyone. That was not an answer that Laura was expecting. If she believed what Sunshine was saying, and the jury was still having a latte break on that one, then she was relieved not to be the sole target of Therese's anger, but was still absolutely none the wiser as to what she could do to appease her. But why is she angry? Sunshine shrugged. She had lost interest in Therese for the moment and was looking forward to her tea. She studied her watch. She could do all of the o'clocks and most of the half-pasts, and anything in between became a nearly. It's nearly 4 o'clock, she said, and tea's at 4 o'clock on the spot. She went and stood by the door. This morning I made fairy cakes, scones, the even lovelier mince pies, and prawn folliphants for our tea. Freddie grinned.
Which explains why you didn't get here until nearly 11:30.
He winked at Laura and mouthed,
luckily for me.
And Dad made sausage rollovers, said Sunshine, pulling on her coat.
Chapter 33 Eunice 1991
These sausage rolls are not a patch on Mrs. Doyle's, said Bomber, bravely soldiering on through his second. Since Mrs. Doyle's retirement to a seafront flat in Margate, the bakery had been taken over by a franchise, and the handmade cakes and patisseries had been replaced with ready-made, mass-produced imitations. Eunice passed him a paper napkin, as flakes of pastry fluttered down his front and into his lap. "I'm sure Baby Jane will happily help with any leftovers," she said, glancing across at the little pug's eager face. Baby Jane was out of luck. Despite its inferior quality, Bomber finished his lunch and did his best to redistribute the flakes of pastry he was wearing in the general direction of the waste paper bin. Eunice had bought him 2 sausage rolls as a special treat, for once forsaking her concern for his health and waistline. They were going to see Grace and Godfrey later, and visits to Folly's End had become increasingly difficult over the past year. She wished that there was something, anything she could do to lessen Bomber's pain, as he watched the man he once knew as his father recede inexorably towards some far, distant, inaccessible horizon. Godfrey's physical health was a bitter irony, cruelly yoked as it was to his mental fragility, leaving him like an overgrown, frightened and angry child. "Body like a buffalo, mind like a moth," was how Grace described him. His plight was a dreadful punishment to those who loved him. To Godfrey, his friends and family were now strangers to be feared and, if possible, avoided. Any attempts at physical affection, a touch, a kiss, a hug, were met with a fist or a kick. Grace and Bomber both had the bruises to prove it. Grace was stoical as ever, but now, almost 2 years after they had moved to Folly's End,
she no longer shared a room with her husband. These days it was only safe to love him from a distance. Portia kept her distance entirely. Her visits had stopped when the violence began. Bomber shook his head in disbelief as he slipped a heavy manuscript from a brown envelope that had arrived with that morning's post. "I'm sure she only does it to wind me up." It was his sister's latest manuscript. "Does she send them to anyone else?" Eunice peered over his shoulder and helped herself to the synopsis sheets. "I'm sure she does. I'm beyond embarrassment now. She definitely sent the last one to Bruce. He said he was almost tempted to publish it just to see the look on my face." Eunice was already engrossed in the pages she was holding, shaking with silent mirth. Bomber leaned back in his chair and tucked his hands behind his head. "Well, come on, then. Put me out of my misery." Eunice wagged her finger at him, grinning. "It's funny you should say that, but I was just thinking that maybe we could get Kathy Bates to kidnap Portia, tie her to a bed in a remote woodland cabin, break both her legs thoroughly with a lump hammer, and then give her some top tips on how to write a novel." When they had first seen the film Misery, they had amused themselves over dinner afterwards by compiling a list of writers who might benefit from a term at the Kathy Bates School of Creative Writing. Eunice couldn't believe that they had forgotten Portia. Might be simpler if she just broke all her fingers, and then she wouldn't be able to write at all. Eunice shook her head at Bomber in mock disapproval. "But then we would be deprived of such literary gems as this," she said, waving the synopsis in the air. She cleared her throat and paused for dramatic effect. Baby Jane yapped at her to get on with it. Janine Eyre is a young orphan being raised by her cruel, wealthy aunt, Mrs. Weed. She is a strange child who sees ghosts, and her aunt tells everyone that she is on drugs and sends her to a private rehab clinic called High Wood. The owner of High Wood, Mr. Bratwurst, spends all the fees on heroin and only feeds the girls bread and lard. Janine makes friends with a kind and sensible girl called Ellen Scalding, who dies when she chokes on a crust of dry bread because there is no nominated first aider on duty, and Janine doesn't know how to do the Heimlich manoeuvre. Eunice paused to check that Bomber wasn't in need of such assistance himself. He was convulsed with silent laughter, and Baby Jane was sitting at his feet looking vaguely puzzled. Eunice waited for him to compose himself a little before continuing. "Mr. Bratwurst is sent to prison for failing to meet the requirements of the health and safety legislation, and Janine accepts the position of au pair at a stately home called Pricklefields in Pontefract, where her charge is a lively little French girl named Belle, and her employer is a dark, brooding man with hidden troubles called Mr. Manchester, who shouts a lot but is kind to the servants. Janine falls in love with him. One evening, he wakes up to find that his hair is on fire, and she saves his life. He proposes. The wedding day is a disaster." "It's not the only thing," spluttered Bomber. Eunice went on. "Just as they are about to exchange their vows, a man called Mr. Mason turns up, claiming that Mr. Manchester is already married to his sister Bunty. Mr. Manchester drags them back to Pricklefields, where they witness Bunty, out of her brains on crack cocaine, crawling round the attic on all fours, snarling and growling and trying to bite their ankles, chased by her carer brandishing a syringe of ketamine. Janine packs her bag. Just as she is about to die from hypothermia, wandering round on the moors, a kind, born-again Christian vicar and his two sisters find her and take her home. As luck would have it, they turn out to be her cousins. And even luckier than that, a long-lost uncle has died and left her all his money. Janine kindly shares her inheritance, but refuses to marry the vicar and join him as a missionary in Lewisham, because she now realizes that Mr. Manchester will always be the love of her life. She returns to Pricklefields to find that it has been burned to the ground. An old lady passing by tells her that the junky bitch Bunty started the fire and died dancing on the roof while it burned. Mr. Manchester bravely rescued all the servants and the kitten, but was blinded by a falling beam and lost one of his ears. Now he is single again, Janine decides to give their relationship another chance. but explains to Mr. Manchester that they will have to take things slowly, as she still has trust issues. 6 weeks later, they marry, and when their first son is born, Mr. Manchester miraculously